Good morning and welcome to Wanda Sticks, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. And we're just playing a little bit of a wonderful selection from Avery Sharp's Sojourner Truth, Ain't I a Woman? And that was called Playing for My People, lyrics by Sojourner Truth, music by Avery Sharp. Welcome to the studio. Thanks to have you. Thanks for being on the show. I told you I'm a little nervous.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Tell us about this wonderful project, and then I'll give some folks some background on your work as a composer, as a professor, as a historian. Tell us about this great tribute to, one of our ancestors who endured enslavement and then went on to work for our freedom in the Civil War, as well as, for women's suffrage.
Well, I've always been a student of history, and I was thinking about doing another project. Many times musicians, we do projects dedicated to different musicians and so forth. Somebody might do something dedicated to Monk or Duke Ellington. And I kind of like to, look at our ancestors. And I was thinking, actually, the truth of the matter is I was thinking about strong black women.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about my mother, because my mother is still here, and she's playing piano, and still, that's where all my music comes from. I was raised in the Church of God in Christ, and she's playing for PR, for choirs and so forth, and had 8 kids, and my father and everything, and so I was just really thinking about her. And then I was thinking about the civil rights movement, and usually when we think of the civil rights movement, we always think of men.
Mm-hmm.
We think of Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Marcus Garvey, W.E. Du Bois, And then if we do think of women, we think of Harriet Tubman and Rosa Parks. And but there's a whole lot of room in between here. And so I started, I live up in Western Massachusetts, and Sojourner Truth spent time in Western Massachusetts. And actually she was, people always think of, whenever we think of slavery in America, we always think of the South, but forgetting that the original 13 colonies, had slaves. And so she was actually a slave in New York, in Ulster County, the Poughkeepsie area. And she was actually owned by Dutch slave owners. So she didn't speak English until she was about 10 or 11, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was, really thinking about her. And it's kind of, everybody's kind of heard her name, but they don't really know what, know the significance or what is that exactly she's done. So I thought it would just be a good project to sort of make folks aware, even if they've heard her name, and those who haven't, exactly what, how significant she is in American history, and particularly African-American history, and also the women's suffrage movement. So I was thinking to dedicate the entire recording to her and write music based on her life.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, the first tune that you heard, Pleading for My People, people don't realize that she was supposed to be considered illiterate. Even though she was a great speaker, she didn't read or write, but she was very religious and had loved having the Bible read to her. And she would write lyrics, inspirational lyrics, as she did, toured and did speaking engagements, and later on when she helped with the black soldiers in the Civil War. But she would make up lyrics. She wasn't a musician, but she might make up lyrics. I think the original tune that went with Pleading for My People was, she would use a popular tune of the day. She used Old Ang Syne.
Oh, wow.
And so then she would make up, tunes for the Civil War soldiers, for the black Civil War soldiers, but she might use the Battle Hymn of the Republic, but change the words,
Mm-hmm.
And so in thinking about, this is just one example, and I'm pleading for my people, she wrote the lyrics, and like I said, sang it to the tune "Auld Lang Syne." So I thought, well, it'd be nice to give it some, you know, music, put some music of today, or music that, as I interpret it, and I interpret it more of a sort of a gospel funk type of sort of interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
I did take some liberties in that I added sort of a chorus. I mean, not a chorus. A chorus there. I'm pleading for my people. That phrase that she came up with, and I just had that, you know, as the hook.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the way that came up. The way that came about. But going back, you know, as I said, this project, I was just thinking about her life and being influenced by what she did. I mean, first of all, you know, she was born in 1797, and she was born, her slave name was Isabella. And for instance, the first tune that I wrote on there is called Isabella's Awakening,
mm-hmm.
Because after she had experienced slavery and had escaped from her master and so forth, and after she moved to New York and New York City, and once she left New York, she was decided to kind of pretty much go on a pilgrimage and for, you know, the abolitionist movement and for women's suffrage. And she changed her name, you know, at that point, because she had been owned by five or six slave owners during her life as a slave, and she just wanted to throw that whole yoke off of her, so she changed her name to Sojourner, which, you know, implies that she's on a, you know, on a pilgrimage. In truth, and people think that she kind of got that from the Bible, from the Book of Mark and in the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's really, I mean, she's really incredible because, you know, to be an African American woman in the, you know, early 1800s, being an abolitionist, and then on top of that, talking about women's rights as well, that was pretty extraordinary. So that's kind of how that the whole project, you know, that's kind of how the whole project came about.
Mhm. Yeah. Yeah, I was just thinking, we did a little reading in the classes that I teach this month, and we were looking at the whole notion of, you know, slavery and then women's rights and the overlap there, and thinking about Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott and the conference that was held, I think, in Seneca Falls, if I'm not mistaken, but I'm not sure. I have to check that. And and how Sojourner Truth, as you know, a free woman, had to, you know, she had, like, she wasn't accepted necessarily as an equal within, you know, the women's rights circles because, you know, black people weren't fully human anyway.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's always been a sort of a schism there. I mean, any kind of oppression, even those who are oppressed can have somewhat of a schism,
mm-hmm.
about how they feel about things. It's like, yes, I'm a woman and I'm downtrodden, but at least I'm not black.
Right.
You know, it's like the whole scenario that poor whites would have sometimes in the South. I mean, a black person could be, you know, a slave and even better off sometimes than a poor white, but the poor white would say, at least I'm not a, you know, the N word.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always been that sort of schism, and the conference that you referred to is the women's conference that was in Akron, Ohio, in 1851.
Oh, that one. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And there were, I mean, people. It's sort of a, you know, everyone acts like, you know, there was sort of this kumbaya moment going on between the abolitionists and the women's rights, but you know, a lot of women's rights advocates did not feel that blacks were equal, and there were a number of abolitionists, even Frederick Douglass, were in involved in the women's rights movement as well. And sometimes there was some friction because it was like, okay, we're having enough problems as it is trying to get our own rights, and then we bring black folks in, and that kind of adds a whole nother element. So there's always been that, you know, that back and forth. I mean, there's no one ever agrees totally on everything, and then you have some folks who would just say, well, you know, it doesn't, you know, we're all in this together. So, you know, there's always been sort of a, like I said, a sort of a schism there.
Right. Yeah. Well, I really enjoyed reading her narrative quite a while ago, and it's really great that, you know, one can read it online, and it's also published. And Nell Painter also did a piece, a book on Sojourner Truth. Did you for your research, did you read her narrative? Of course you did. And any other particular books to be able to write these songs?
Well, yes. I read her narrative. I went back and did a couple of books that were written about Sojourner Truth. I also went back and looked at some of the some of her speeches, mm-hmm. Some of her narratives, and some of the tunes that she wrote as well. I can't. There's a book I can't even think of the name of it right now. Memories, but yes, there was a number of research that, you know, that I did, and went back, and not only just, you know, like I said, not only just her narrative, but to get other people's mm-hmm. impressions of her as you know, as well.
Right.
And that's how I came up, you know, with there were, you know, several songs, and that's how I learned about the songs that she had. As a matter of fact, and I'm pleading for my people, there was about two or three different versions. And I had to kind of piece it together. I mean, some of the lyrics were similar. Then you might see another version where the third stanza might have changed a few of the words around. So I kind of you know, like kind of pieced and mealed, you know, the between the two or three examples that I had to come up with the version that I finally came up with.
Mhm. Right. Yeah. Well, I'm going to read your bio now, and it's from your website, and wanted to mention that you are a TMO artist, and on your bio it says that honesty, clarity, dignity, these are words that come to mind when you listen to the music of bassist composer Avery Sharp. In an age of ephemeral pop stars and flavor of the month trends, Sharp is a reminder of the lasting value of steadfast dedication and personal integrity. As the title of one of his tunes asserts, always expect the best of yourself. Sharp was born in Valdosta, Georgia. And his first instrument, as you already mentioned, was the piano. And you were playing with your mother. You write that you started playing when you were 8 years old, and your mother was a piano player in the Church of God in Christ, and she gave lessons to everybody in the family, and you're the sixth of eight children. But these lessons didn't stick until it got to you. And then you moved on to accordion, which I think is pretty cool. And then
that was a strange black kid, yeah. That was strange.
Yeah, accordion. That's pretty neat, because I know they play accordion, you know, in the African diaspora, like particularly you think about Congo and the music that comes out of there, usually an accordion, I've heard accordion music mixed in that type of musical tradition. And then you switched to electric bass in high school. You enrolled at the University of Massachusetts, where you studied economics and continued to play electric bass in gospel, funk, and rock groups. And while at UMass, you met the jazz bassist Reggie Workman. He's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he encouraged you to learn the acoustic bass. You adapted quickly to the big instrument, and within a few years, you were performing with such notables as R.G. Shepp and Art Blakey. In 1980s, you auditioned with McCoy Tyner and won a spot in the pianist group, and you worked with Tyner almost continuously for 20 years, playing hundreds of live gigs and appearing on more than 20 records. Your credits also include sidemen stints with other jazz greats from Dizzy Gillespie to Pat Metheny, as well as leading your own groups. And your first recording as a leader was the 1988 album Unspoken Words on Sunnyside Records, which was praised by a lot of critics. In 1994, you recorded Extended Family, the first CD of a trilogy that includes Extended Family 2, Thoughts of My Ancestors, 1995, Extended Family 3, Family Values, 2001, and recording Dragonfly on JKNM Records, and that was released in 2005. And that features Winard Harper and Unaje Allen Gums, with special guests Jerry Brown and Chico Freeman. Legends and Mentors, the music of McCoy Tyner, Archie Shepp, and Yusuf Lateef was released in 2008. So that's neat. How's Yusuf Lateef doing?
He's doing great.
Excellent.
Yusuf is, you know, he'll be 93 this October.
Oh, my goodness.
He's one of my
so
favorite
cool.
people. I call him about once a month, and
they
just talk. Brother Yusuf, just say something, because every time you speak, I learn. Great guy.
Yeah, he is awesome. He is really awesome. And that particular recording, Legends and Mentors, that features John Blake, Joe Ford, Winard Harper again, and Unaje Allen Gums again. And all these recordings were released on your own label, JKNM Records. And your latest recording, but that's not your latest, I don't believe, Autumn Moonlight, is released in April 2009. And that features your trio with Winard Harper and Unaje Allen Gums. And you should visit his website and read the rest of this. I wanted to get to the other. Oh, there it is. You recently composed music for a one actor musical portrait based on the Harlem Renaissance title Raising Cain, and you were commissioned by the Chamber Music Plus 2004 to write the music for this portrait. And this musical portrait was on tour 2007 to 2008, and it features actress Jasmine Guy and the Avery Sharp Trio, with yourself on bass, John Blake on violin, and Kevin Sharp on percussion. Is that your brother?
That's my brother, my baby brother.
Okay, cool. So who's on Ain't I a Woman?
Well, there's a gosh, I'm tired from God, I did all that. Huh? I need to go take a nap. But yeah, because after Autumn Moonlight, I did live trio with Winard Harper and Unaje. That was my trio at the time.
Okay.
And then 2011, I did Running Man, and then last year, I released the Sojourner Truth project. And on the Sojourner Truth project, I have Unaje Allen Gums on piano, Jerry Brown on, she's doing the vocals, Dwayne Eubanks on trumpet, Craig Handy on saxophone, who's from Northern California.
Yeah, we know Craig.
And Yaron Israel on drums.
Nice.
Great ensemble of
Yeah,
people.
Yeah, you all are great. So when are you coming this way again?
I'm not sure. I'm sure my agent TMO Entertainment, I'm sure they're working on something for the West Coast. But right now I don't think there's anything happening. There could be, but I may be forgetting it. But right now I don't think there's anything happening.
Okay. Yeah. So Sojourner Truth is really well known for one of her speeches, as if, you know, she didn't make others, and people might not actually know that she actually did make other speeches, and that she has a narrative that was published, you know, quite a while ago, and she lived she lived quite a long time, and I was wondering if you could tell us about, you know, this most famous of her speeches, because in your liner notes, which are very comprehensive, and when you present, like when people see you perform Sojourner Truth and I Woman, I hear that you have a slideshow, and it's like, you know, quite comprehensive.
Yeah, it's really sort of a journey.
Mm-hmm.
through time and a journey through her life, and I have a video slideshow that is projected on the screen behind us, and as I do the tunes, I project images indicative, like I said, of her life. I mean, there's no, it's not like it is today where people have their video cameras and can pretty much document everything. But it's sort of a journey through through African American history. That's going on. And then I also describe the tunes, describe incidents in her life that she experienced, and also that inspired me, to write. For instance, there's a tune, "Son of Mine," that I wrote.
Mm-hmm.
What people don't understand is that she got a lot of help from the Quakers. The Quakers were abolitionists, and that's why you see the way that she's dressed and so forth. But she was the first African American woman to sue a white man and win. What happened was when she left slavery, when she escaped, she left. She took her youngest daughter with her, but she left her youngest son there. And you know how the political system is now. People think things are slow, but back then they were even slower. So New York had slavery, but they said they were going to end it, but it was going to take, 10 or 20 years. And so if you were a slave and that the law was passed in 5 or 10 years or whenever it was, I can't remember exactly when, you would be free. So what people have to realize is that, slaves were property. So as if I have slaves and suddenly they're going to be free in, say, 5 or 10 years, that means the value of, my property is going to it's going to be gone. So what people would try to do, and then what they made it against the law to do is, okay, I know slavery's still happening down south, so I'll sell my slave down south. But you could that was against the law, and that's what happened to her son. The slave master sold her son to a person who was going to take him to England, but then the guy decided not to take him to England and bought him back. And then her son was sold to a slave master in the South. So, she, of course, was highly upset that her son was sold. And she bought a lawsuit with the help of the Quakers. And I believe it was in Poughkeepsie, New York. As a matter of fact, they have a plaque there. The lawyer, who was a Quaker, took the case for $5, and he won the case. They won the case, and that was the first documented case of an African-American woman. I'm not sure if it's just first black person, period, but definitely an African-American woman suing a white person and actually winning the case.
Wow, that's great. Well, it just so happens, I actually uploaded that one to play. So why don't we let our audience listen to Son of Mine?
Son of mine, oh son of
Necessarily chronological, and I was wondering if you could talk about your research on the famous speech "Ain't I a Woman?" And you know, you have, you know, you actually put the speech in the liner notes. However, Sojourner Truth, as you already mentioned, she didn't read and write, so she didn't actually have her speech that she could hand over to someone and say, okay, you can publish this. Could you talk about sort of how we came to know the speech the way we know it right now?
Well, you know, it's funny. As I mentioned before, when we think of slavery, we always think of the South. And many times the depiction of Sojourner is... When people reenact the speech, they always do it with a Southern accent. But she wasn't raised in the South. She was actually raised in the North, and she didn't speak English until she was 10 or 11 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So her accent would have been a little different. But yes, as a, you know, she didn't read or write, and the speech, you know, she didn't write down any notes. She got up and spoke, and she never titled her speech "Ain't I a Woman." Originally, the first recorded version was by Marius Robinson, who was a friend of hers, an abolitionist and newspaper editor. He wrote down a version which was different. And then later, Frances Dana Barker Gage, she was at the convention as well, and immediately after, she wrote a different version. And then I believe like some 12 years later, she published a totally different version, and she added the title "Ain't I a Woman,"
mm-hmm.
Referring to that's what Sojourner put in the speech. But I don't think Sojourner actually said those exact words.
Mm-hmm.
She implied them,
uh-huh.
Those were the written version was the one that Gage came up with, and that kind of became sort of the common accepted one. The common accepted speech,
mm-hmm.
But I think the essence is definitely, you know, is there.
Right.
I think, you know, Gage may have done a little different interpretation. It's always interesting when the originator of something, a person interpreting what the originator has, sometimes is not always exactly what the person had in mind, but it's probably pretty close.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's you know, when I think about what I read about her family, her mother and her father, and how you know, she was separated from them, and you know, because they were elders, no one wanted to buy them. So, you know, you could tell me if what you read is the same, that they just, you know, starved and.
Well, what happened is, as I understand it, mm-hmm. and which was interesting when I started, you know, doing research, you know, because I've been, you know, historian for quite a number of years,
mm-hmm.
you know, and of course, African American history and gospel music and jazz.
Right.
And it's something that really hit me, you know, reading about Sojourner and her parents. We always think, whenever we think of slavery, we always think of slaves when they're young and when, you know, they're forced to work and when they're beaten and, you know, yes, their property and, you know, the whole, you know, being treated like cattle, being bred, you know, the whole thing. But there's an aspect that I kind of skim over. Is that what do you do in a slave when they can't do any more work or they're injured or they're old?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this obviously comes out in her narrative and about her parents. Her father was slave name was James, and he was called Bomfrey. Bomfrey in Low Dutch means strong, like a tree.
Mm-hmm.
He was a big guy and strong, but when he became old and couldn't work anymore, he was put off the plantation. Just, you got to go. You know, like, pretty much like you would do an animal, a dog, you know. If, you know, I'm sure back in the day they didn't put dogs to sleep. They just put them out in the woods and let the animals, you know, take care of them. And that's kind of pretty much what they did with him. His Sojourner Truth's mother was sold to another master, but she still could work. And so, as I understand it, her husband, which, you know, she would try to feed him scraps, you know, from what she got, because, you know, he wasn't no longer productive, and he couldn't stay with her because, you know, she was owned by somebody else.
Hmm.
And I think there was like an old shack somewhere, because we have to, like I said, we have to understand this is not the South, it's the North.
Mm-hmm.
And they found him, her father, frozen, you know.
Oh, man.
He starved to death.
Yeah.
And she believes a lot of the injuries or a lot of his aches came from, you know, when they were owned by the, when they were younger, they stayed in the basement,
mm-hmm.
of the master's house. And it's not like today, you know, where you have a basement redone. It was, you know, it was a basement. It was cold and damp and dark and, not really great conditions for after you get through working all day. She believes that also had an effect on his health and his deterioration.
Hmm.
But, yeah, it was just, you know, we don't think about that aspect of it. What happened to slaves when they were no longer useful? What was done with them?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah. Wow. Yeah, you write about how you've always found inspiration in your ancestors, those who came before you to uplift you spiritually, socially, and musically. And you write that Winston Churchill once said of history, the further backward you can look, the farther forward you can see. And and then when I was reading your bio, there were those volumes of music that seem to be dedicated to your family?
Yes, it's called the Extended Family Series. It was
mm-hmm.
a trilogy.
Yes.
The first Extended Family was inspired by my father. You know, it was eight of us, and my father was extremely proud of his family, and you know, really taught me everything that there is to be about family and about being a man. And you know, he comes from that generation. You know, he was a World War II veteran, you know, from the South, and like many African Americans during that time, we, you know, we got the job that nobody else wanted. He was in the Navy. He was a steward, you know, on a ship. And you know, just thinking about his life and my mother's life, and like I said, the values that he taught us, and how proud he was of his family. I mean, you know, he, there's eight of us, and we, you know, same father, and all lived in the same household, and the values that he taught us have shaped our entire life. So that first record was really sort of dedicated to him and the values that he taught. And then once I did that first record, I started thinking about, you know, of course, the people who came even before him, our ancestors, you know, the Native American side of me and the African side.
Mm-hmm.
And I started thinking about, you know, the second part of the trilogy was called Extended Family 2, Thoughts of My Ancestors, which sort of was sort of a double meaning. I mean, thinking about the people that I never met, you know, umpteenth generations back, but that, you know, that was the process that made me, you know. So it's sort of a double meaning. I was wondering what, thinking about them, these people I never knew, and how significant and important they were to me just being on this planet. Thinking about them, but not only thinking about them, also wondering what their thoughts were, their actual thoughts, going through, you know, in the hull of a slave ship, or, you know, whatever hardships that they had to go through. What were their actual thoughts? How did they deal with this? You know, which is what I always find inspiration. And you know, it's like whatever it is I'm going through, it might be tough, but it's, you know, by comparison, you know, in a dark in a dark belly of a slave ship, in your excrement and you know, feces and stuff, and not being able to communicate with people, that can be somewhat of a, you know, the ultimate test there.
Mm-hmm.
And what, you know, what is actually going through your mind, and how do you deal with that? How do you come through with that? And so, thinking about my ancestors and also their actual thoughts, and then to complete the trilogy, I was thinking of Extended Family 3, Family Values. Then I just really narrowed it down, took those actual values that my parents, you know, gave me. And it's funny because during the time that I wrote did the record, I had to put like a little disclaimer that I'm not affiliated with any political group or anything like that, because, you know, family values for a while had become sort of a dirty word, and was really used not by, it wasn't used what I feel correctly, you know.
Mm-hmm.
People used it more to separate people and rather than to bring people together. So I was just really just talking about those very simple values that my parents taught my brothers and sisters, and not imposing those upon anybody else. These are just the values that, simple values that we were taught, and that helped me get through life, and that I try to pass on to my kids.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of how that whole trilogy, that whole family value, I mean, that whole extended family,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, as they say, it takes a village, you know, to raise a child. So I was, you know, not only, like I said, thinking about my father and his influence on me, but, you know, the neighborhood as well. I mean, if you did something, you know, when I was a kid, by the time you got home, your parents already knew what you had done. You know, you know, it was people were looking out for each other. People were, You know, because sometimes I'll see a kid doing something now, and I'll want to say something, and I'll be like, I don't know, because people are funny now. But back in the day, somebody saw me, you know, an elder person saw me doing something that I maybe shouldn't have been doing as a kid. They would say, hey, what are you doing? I'm going to tell you, you know. And you knew you were going to be in trouble, not only with them, but when you got home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you trace your ancestry, where, you know, what indigenous nations are a part of your ancestry, and where is your family from in Africa, on the continent?
Well, I'm not really sure. Like many black folks, we just know it's probably West Africa.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure in terms of what tribes or what country.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of Sharps in South Carolina, and Georgia is where I was born, you know, where my father was born.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother was born in Florida. And there are a number of Sharps, you know, in that Waycross, Georgia area.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, my mother's from Florida, and it's thought that her grandmother was Native American, but I'm not sure from what tribe that she claims. So that's, you know, that's kind of it on that.
Mhm. Yeah, and I believe because when you write about Sojourner Truth's parents, you say that her enslaved African parents were James and Elizabeth Bomfree, and where were her parents from? Where were they?
Well, it's thought that her father was directly from Africa. He wasn't like you know, first generation or anything like that. They think it might have been Ghana.
Mhm. Yeah, I think that's what I read too. Mhm. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've kept you on longer than I said, and you've been really kind to hang in there with me. So I don't know if you need to go now or.
Well, it's up to you. I've got a couple more minutes.
You do? Okay.
I'm fine.
Okay, super. Yeah, when I was looking for you, because I last saw you when you were here in town with Archie Shepp, and I was just so, like, starstruck because I had been listening to Being a Woman for quite a while. And then actually, like, Avery Sharp, he's the composer. Oh, my God. That's him in the flesh. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, and you were so so kind. You told me, well, you know, just get in touch with me. And it took me several months, like more than several, actually, to get in touch with you because that was last year. And as I was looking for you, I knew that you were also part of faculty, and I wasn't certain what college, and then I found you online, you know, at Williams College, and spoke to someone who was in the department, and you weren't in that particular afternoon that I called. So she gave me your email address, and I stuck it in one of my textbooks and misplaced it.
Oh, wow.
For another couple of months. So anyway, so tell us about how you marry your scholarship with your music and your creativity. I bet it's really wonderful having you as a professor.
Well, yeah, I'm just I'm at Williams College, and I'm instructor in acoustic bass, and also have a small jazz ensemble, and I'm a faculty advisor for the gospel choir. So it's, you know, it's really part time. But although last semester, fall semester of 2012, they offered me a Sterling Brown who was an African American literature person, graduated actually from Williams. I think it was 1921 or 1923.
Oh my, yeah, he's a famous poet. Yeah.
And you know, he taught at Howard University. He was one of Stokely Carmichael's professors, as a matter of fact.
Oh man.
Back in the day.
Wow.
And he went to Williams College. He's a graduate of Williams College.
Mm-hmm.
And they set up a an endowment in his honor, probably 20-something years ago, where they would bring in a special guest artist, either in literature or in music. It's combined with the Africana department at Williams and the music department. And the head of the Africana department suggested that maybe they'd bring me in as the Sterling Brown professor for that semester, because it's only one semester.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, you're brought in to, you know, to be on campus and to be, you know, part of the community.
Mm-hmm.
And bring your expertise. And you teach a course in whatever you want. And I taught a course, I made up a course on John Coltrane.
Mm-hmm.
In the revolutionary tradition in African American music,
uh-huh.
And so it was quite. And I also came in as a visiting artist as well, and I did the whole Sojourner Truth project with my group and with the whole video slide show. And I did some lectures as well, not only with on the John Coltrane course that I was doing, but also on Sojourner Truth.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, what's today? Friday. Is it next week? Going to be coming in as a special guest in one of the Africana classes. It's about the you know, revolutionary civil rights movement and some of the artists. And one of the artists I'm going to speak about is Max Roach and Abby Lincoln.
Oh, nice.
Because I was very fortunate that when I was in college and at the University of Massachusetts, I had Archie Shepp was actually one of my professors.
Mm.
That's how I came to meet Archie. And Max Roach was also my professor. He was at the University of Massachusetts at that time.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so, and Reggie Workman used to come up a couple days a week from New York, and that's when I started acoustic bass.
Mm-hmm.
So I was fortunate enough to have Archie Shepp, Max Roach, and Reggie Workman
wow.
on campus. And, you know, it's hard to get those cats together in New York at one time, and here I had them on campus at one time, and when I first started playing, they all took an interest in me. Obviously, they saw something that I didn't. And first gigs I started doing with people on that level was, you know, with Reggie. I started doing regional gigs with him, and then he was the first person to take me to Europe.
Mm.
And then that's when people like Art Blakey and McCoy Tyner, all those people started hearing about me.
Wow, what a wonderful foundation.
Yeah, I was really fortunate. So it's nice to be in a sort of an academic setting where you can kind of give back as well and kind of pass on what has been passed on to you from the purveyors of this music.
Mhm. Yeah, you think about the Freedom Now speech, right?
Oh yeah, definitely going to talk about yes.
Man. Yeah, and you know, and how you know you talk about banned, you know, from the airwaves.
Right.
And
yeah, you know, it affects your career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sometimes people take a stance, and
mm-hmm.
sometimes it's easier to just try to go under the radar, and then sometimes it's like, hey, no. I mean, you know, we can go into Max, but I mean, you know, not only did Max bring the drums to the forefront, but also social, you know, social issues as well that needed to be dealt with. Sometimes artists don't want to deal with them, but he did.
Mm-hmm.
And took some hits for that.
Yeah, yeah. Cause people, you know, people remember, you know, Paul Robeson and the hits that he took, you know, for his speaking out about, you know, sort of, you know, the workers' rights and things like that. And then he couldn't even leave the country for quite a while.
Yeah, and was, you know, couldn't work in this country for quite some time as well. And, you know, all people remember is that he was a communist, you know, which is a, you know, really a bad thing, you know, considering that the system that you had working for black folks wasn't working. He decided, well, let's try something else here.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's a whole nother that's a whole nother discussion.
Right. Yeah. And then now, you know, quite a few of these people you mentioned, you know, are no longer with us. You know, our Blakey, Max Roach,
yeah.
You know, Abby Lincoln, you know,
right.
You know, Shea, for all of them. And so, you know, you're carrying them with you.
No, I've been very fortunate, very blessed, and sometimes I've, you know, when I'm in class, I forget that, you know, my students will be saying something about somebody, or like a Freddie Hubbard, and I'll be like, I played with Freddie. No, we didn't play it that way, you know. Or I played with Dizzy. He sometimes changed it around, you know, or did a different arrangement or whatever. And then I have to realize that, wow, that's right, these people are no longer here. I was very fortunate to been able to share the stage with them and acquire a great deal of energy and knowledge from them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's good to be in sort of an academic setting where I can pass that down as well.
Mhm. Yeah. Well, it's also really great, you know, that you make these you know, these documents, you know, that we can listen to and learn from. You know, we can enjoy the music and then we can read what you write, you know, about the inspiration and the history, and which is just really wonderful as well.
Yeah, well, I feel that music is supposed to, well, I mean, as you know, everybody, every artist, you know, has an idea of how they feel that they should fit in this whole puzzle, and I just feel that, you know, music should be inspiring,
mm-hmm.
always. You know, when people come to see you or listen to you, they, you know, they should be able to do their job better or think
mm-hmm.
better or, you know, just look at the world differently.
Right, yeah. Well, I'm going to play some more of your music, and thank you so much for being with us. I was thinking about we have time for maybe two more, so I was going to play Virtuous She Is. I thought that was really a nice piece. And
well, that was actually written by, I had Onaje, mm-hmm. Alan Gums, and Yaron Israel, and Craig Handy also contribute a tune to the project, and Virtuous She Is, that's actually Yaron Israel's tune.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, and Fu was speaking about her parents, I was thinking about playing Bum Free, which I believe is for her dad.
Yeah, that's for her father, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you don't mind.
That'd be great.
Okay. So you could stay with us and listen if you like. Or I could tell you thank you so much for joining us, and hopefully, you know, we'll be able to continue this conversation at another time.
Definitely. Well, I'll listen for a little bit, but I'm going to have to call it a day here.
Okay. Well, it's been a lovely, lovely morning speaking with you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay. Let's see. The Way Home. Did I say The Way Home? I'm not sure.
No, you said Virtuous She Is.
Virtuous She Is, thank you. I've got a couple of them in here. I like The Way Home, too. That's another nice one. I thought, I might play that later on in the show. was Avery Sharp. And we are going to be continuing our look at the life of Sojourner Truth with guests who are part of the opera troupe. Yes, you didn't know that there was an opera, a folk opera, a new folk opera about Sojourner Truth, the ex-slave, fiery abolitionist, and women's rights pioneer. And we have in the studio Paula M. Kemper, who is the composer. Good morning, Paula. How are you?
Good morning. I'm right here. I'm fine. Thank you.
Great. And we have Linda McErney.
McInerney,
yeah, who is the director, co-creator, and co-conceiver, and she has this great story she's going to tell us about how truth came to her, literally. And and we were going to be joined by the vocalist Mary Yan Pringle, but she is out of the country and is traveling at this time, so we're not going to have her in the studio, but we're going to listen to her because we have a little bit of music. So why don't we start talking, and then I'll go back and read your bios. So Linda, why don't you start and tell us how you assembled all these fabulous women and were able to put together this wonderful production that, unfortunately, for those who are listening, it happened, it was on February 16th this year. Tell us about that first performance.
Well, first of all, Wanda, it's such an honor and a blessing to be on your show. So thank you so much for having us and giving us the opportunity to talk with you about Sojourner Truth. We really appreciate you and the work that you do. So the way it all began, it's kind of an amazing story. Paula Kemper, who is with us right now. Hi, Paula. How are you, dear?
I'm good. Thank you.
Good. We had worked previously together on another opera that Paula composed. It was called The Captivation of Eunice Williams. And we had an absolutely joyful, creative time building that opera and taking it to various places around the country and around the world. Loved doing that. And we were looking and looking and looking for another project to create together. And the right topic never quite came to us. We wanted to tell the true story of a woman in American history who had been neglected, and we wanted to tell a story that had some resonance for where I personally live and where my theater company is located, which is in Western Massachusetts. And it never quite came to us through all of our research about what that story might be. And then, honestly, one night I had a literal dream. It was in the wee hours, it was probably about 3 a.m, and I had a flash of an image of an African American woman standing on stage, dressed in mid-19th century garb. Paula and I were sitting in a theater. It's a theater called the Academy of Music Theater, beautiful theater in Northampton, Massachusetts, and we were feeling very happy. That was sort of the sense of the dream, and this woman opened her mouth to sing, and I saw the baton of the conductor there, and then I woke up. And in that moment of waking, it was really clear, it was like a flash, that this was an opera about Sojourner Truth. And I thought, that's a great idea, because though I didn't know much about this part of the story, there is a beautiful bronze statue in Florence, Massachusetts. And I had heard hearsay and tell of Sojourner Truth having been in Florence and Northampton, and there was some connection with her there that I didn't know much about. But I thought, there's something there. This is a really beautiful story that I need to learn more about and see if we could bring this to life. So I actually jumped out of bed and went downstairs onto my desktop computer and Googled Sojourner Truth to see what had been created about her life. And looked and looked and looked and looked and got about 10 or 15 Google pages in and realized that very little had been done about her life. And that really got my emotions sparked, and I realized that this really was a job that needed to be done. And I found a few things. I found a couple of choral pieces. I found some lovely reenactors who go into elementary schools and reenact, you know, scenes from her life. But no big movie, no big musical, no big opera, no big play. And so I really felt moved that this was my calling at this point. And so I waited till a decent hour. I didn't want to wake poor Paula up at 4:30 in the morning. I waited till about 9 o'clock in the morning, and then I gave her a call. And I said, Paula, I really think I've got it. I really do. I think this is the one. And she just simply said yes. And then I called, and then a librettist I know, a wonderful African-American librettist named Talia Delaney, just a beautiful poetess who was working at Vassar College at that time in Poughkeepsie, New York. And I gave her a call and said, I've got the idea. Will you do this with me? And she said, absolutely. She was completely on board with the project, and we began from there. And it took us a couple of years, but we built it bit by bit by bit with love in our hearts, and there you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the rest is easy.
So, Paula, tell us about, yes, you know, sort of when you got this call. That was a decent hour, but it was pretty early. What do you think? You know, your partner, you all, you know, you had some history together. So, you know, you were used to Linda's creative inspirations.
Well, it's not only that creative inspirations, because we had talked over a number of different ideas, and none of them had sort of clicked or rung a bell, but this one really did.
Mm-hmm.
When I heard Sojourner Truth, I thought, oh, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I said yes.
Okay.
It's a great story, and I, the first opera we did, also the story struck me as, oh, my God, this is American history, and I don't know that. I don't know that story, so I want to learn it myself, and I feel it's a story that must be told. And it was the same with Sojourner Truth. I have the same experience a lot of people do. We spent the day on her in elementary school, and I've heard that name, and I know she made a speech sometime, but that's it. I don't know anything about her. And so I wanted to learn about her, and I wanted to then tell the story. She's such a remarkable woman who started so much important work that is still going on today and still inspiring people today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Elaborate on that a little bit. You know, what work did she do that's continuing today?
Well, we think of her right now in terms of the Emancipation Proclamation anniversary, and that the fact that she went and met with Abraham Lincoln and told him that the slavery has got to stop. He wasn't that nice to her. That's why we didn't put him in our opera. But the fact was, she was a pioneer in the fact that she was the one African American woman out there saying slavery must be ended. And she was an advocate for women's rights as well, even though everyone said, oh, well, we have to get rights for men first. But she was still pushing for that and never actually lived to see women have the vote, although she herself went to vote once when she was living in Battle Creek. She went and voted, and they said, you can't vote. She said, I have a right to vote. She did it. She was such a pioneer. And as we found out today, human trafficking, human slavery is still rampant in the world. It's not over. And we're going to take this opera to places where that's still where there's still work to be done to solve that.
Well, that's wonderful. Wow. Yeah. I want to play the clip you sent me, That Man Over There.
Yeah.
And then we'll continue our conversation. I'll introduce you. I'll read your bios.
All right.
Continue our conversation.
That's great. Okay. Thank you, Wanda.
Sure, no problem.
Women need to be helped into carriages and lifted over my saddle. No one ever helped me. And
how was the performance received?
Oh, it was wonderful, Wanda. We've actually had the great luxury of sharing it several times.
Mm-hmm.
We had a culminating performance a year ago in February of 2012 where we had nearly 100 people participating in a performance at the very same Academy of Music in Northampton where Dream took place. And we had three performances of that show, and each of them were sold out. So about 2,400 people saw the very first premiere.
I'm just going to interject in there that was of the full opera. It's a full grand opera.
Yeah.
And then, subsequent to that, we've made a chamber version.
Okay. Yeah,
and
yeah,
the chamber version came about.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the chamber version came about when I asked Paula what her dream was, and Paula said that her dream, actually, I shouldn't speak for you, Paula. What is your dream, Paula?
You know
Paula
my Kimper, dream.
Tell us your dream, dear.
You're in my head. You know my dream. I wanted to create a chamber version that we could take on tour immediately, because it takes a long time in the opera world for scheduling and for productions to be developed, years of time. And we felt the impulse to really get this out right away. So I wanted to create a chamber version, and I also wanted to conduct it myself.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we've done since then, and now we're ready to go on tour.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, so you were saying at the beginning, Wanda, that you were sad that you had missed the performance, but here's the beauty of the chamber version of the opera. Since it's five singers playing a variety of different roles and a chamber orchestra of only seven, we have just placed this out into the world, and it will go wherever it wants to go. So I feel strongly that you will have many opportunities to see truth as we move forward in the future. And we even have one booking that took place before we even finished the chamber version. And we were invited to an international opera and theater festival in Eastern Europe. It's called Scoopy Fest, S-K-U-P-I, Fest as in festival. And it's taking place in Skopje, Macedonia. And we are now working very hard with some partners there to not only bring the opera to Macedonia, but also to Kosovo and also to Albania. And that was and one of the important things about the opera going there is what Paula was saying previously, is that the problem of human trafficking is one of the foremost problems on this earth in this moment. And this is the story of a woman who not only freed herself from slavery, but spent her life working for the freedom for all.
Mm-hmm.
So off we go.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah. Well, that's amazing. So if people are interested in the chamber orchestra version of Truth,
yes,
how do
they
get in touch with
many.
You?
It's so easy. It's a website that will stay in your mind. It's Truth Opera, one word. You can't
Truth
forget
opera.
It. So all you have to do is go to truthopera.com, and you will learn so many things about our opera itself, where we're going, how to be in touch with us. We have a Gmail address at truthopera@gmail.com. You can't forget that. And just get in touch with us, and you can see everything that we've done since the get-go and the things that we'll be doing in the future. And you can help be a part of the future if you want to by just getting in touch with us.
Well, let me read your bio. Linda, we'll start with you. Again, you are the director, co-creator, and co-convener, and founder and artistic director of Oh Deerfield Productions.
Yeah.
You're a graduate of Middlebury College and the National Shakespeare Company Conservatory, and earned a MFA in directing from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. You have been a member of Actors Equity since 1983. With Oh Deerfield Productions, you have produced and directed dozens of productions of contemporary and classical plays and music theater works, including five world premieres.
Isn't that fun? Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. World premieres, that's awesome. And not to mention that those are brand new. And commissioned new works. You commissioned new works, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's all possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a partial list of your credits include The Glass Menagerie, The Belle of Amherst, Light Spirit, Seal Skin, John Brown's Body, Women of the Valley, Rashomon, The Miser, Prize Crossing, Plain Song, Molly Sweeney, She Stoops to Conquer, Wit, Waiting for Godot, The Cure of Troy, at Troy, The Resistible Rise of Arturo. How do you pronounce the last part?
Louis. The Louis. Resistible Rise of Arturo. That was a fun one. Yeah.
Yeah. The Importance of Being Earnest, Don Juan, and Doubt. The Captivation of Eunice Williams, the new opera you created with Paula and Harley Erdman, was performed at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of the American Indian in 2006 and by the Albanian National Theater as the headline production at the Ohrid Festival in Macedonia in 2008. So is this the one you were mentioning, Paula?
Yes, that's the first one we did together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what's the story there?
Well, it's a local story to Deerfield, Massachusetts, and it happened in 1704 when the French and the Canadians raided Deerfield and captured 111 people, English colonists, and marched them back to Canada. Many died on the way, many were killed. And the captives who were in Canada, the children in particular, were adopted by the Native American communities, Mohawks, Abenaki, and such. And this one girl, Eunice Williams, was adopted by Mohawks. And when her parents, her English parents, tried to get her back, she refused. And she remained in the Mohawk community and became a tribal leader among them. Her descendants are still there today. We collaborated with them in the making of the opera. And when she was an adult, she came back into New England and made peace with her English family. And that bridge still continues to this day between the families. So that's really the core story, is this peacemaking across cultures.
Wow, that's amazing. That's really amazing. Yeah. And Paula M. Kemper, composer, is a graduate of the Eastman School of Music. Her first opera, Patience and Sarah, based on a novel by Isabel Miller and written with librettist Wendy Pearson's, premiered at the 1998 Lincoln Center Festival and has received further productions in Denver, Chicago, England, and Oakland, California.
Oakland. Yes.
Really?
Oakland, California. Yes.
Okay.
What, I know, right around the corner. There
yeah.
you go.
When was that?
That was in 2007.
Oh, that's pretty recent.
Yeah.
The Act Two duet, I Want to Live, was featured on CRI's release, Lesbian American Composers, and won two 1999 Glamma Awards. Douglas Moser's A Christmas Carol, featuring Kemper's score, won the 1992 Connecticut Critics Circle Award for Best Adaptation of a Classic. In 2002, she was commissioned to compose The Captivation of Eunice Williams, and we already mentioned that, that collaboration with Linda's company.
Yeah.
And it says that you are currently at work on an opera based on Thornton Wilde's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Bridge of San Luis Rey.
Yes, I am.
Okay, how's that coming along?
That's been in the works for a while because I had to put it on hold to do these other two huge operas.
Yes.
but it's still in the works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell us more about Truth and, you know, the cast, the opera, you know, with the cast and working with the librettist, Talia Delaney. How does that work when you, Paula, when you collaborate with a librettist? You know, she has the words and you have the music, or did you have the music and she put the words to it? How does that work?
Well, it's pretty a common phrase in opera is prima la parole, which is Italian for first the words. And that is really where you must start. I had some musical ideas before the words started to appear, but really the words are what lend the direction for the music and the rhythm and everything that comes out after. So we met with Talia for about a year to develop the story. Sojourner's Truth's life has many, many extraordinary events and occurrences, and we had to then pick the ones which we felt told the story the best and were the most dramatic and structure our libretto. And as soon as Talia would start writing words, I would go to the piano and begin to set them to music. So it develops over time. We started out with a workshop at Temple University in Philadelphia with just the first four scenes of the opera. We collaborated with their theater department. And then that was, let's see, that was April of 2011. By July of 2011, I had written the whole first act. And we did that in Deerfield. Mm-hmm. And then by September of 2011, I had written the second act. We presented that here in New York City, where I live, in Harlem, in a collaboration with the Harlem Opera Theater. And by December of that year, I had written Act 3, and we presented that in a workshop at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts. And this was the development phase. And then by the February of 2012, we had the whole opera, which was then the premiere.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes a while to write it off.
Yeah, how large a cast did you have for the opera? And in comparison, you said you have seven in the chamber.
Right,
we had over 30
people in the chorus in the initial premiere. So there were up close to 50 people on stage during the show for the premiere with the full opera and the orchestra. What was the number of the people in the orchestra, Paula? Can
16.
You remember?
16. Yeah, 16. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So now in the chamber version, we have five singers and a seven-piece orchestra.
Okay.
So it's much more mobile and light and fancy-free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so in the chamber version of the opera, are you working with some of the same people that you work with in the larger comprehensive piece, and also, do you have to leave out certain things in the chamber, or is it just the actors, singers are just performing more parts?
Well, Paula,
go
ahead, Paula. Go ahead, sweetie. Go.
Well, yes, it's a good point. We did have to leave out some of the scenes because they required too many actors. And these performers are singing multiple roles,
mm-hmm.
Except for Sojourner. She's just herself through the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
There are a whole new cast because I'm based in New York City. We decided to have an open call for auditions, and we cast New York-based musicians so that we could develop it here in New York So they're all from here. It's all a new cast.
Okay. So as a director, Linda, how were you able to manage all these different aspects of the production? And are you
really interesting? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What was your other question?
And I was wondering, are you connected to the chamber version as well?
Yes, I am. It's been a really interesting process, though, because another piece of Paula's dream, in addition to crafting the chamber version and being the conductor, her other dream is to be the producer, which is, I've never heard of a composer producing his or her own work. So that's really amazing and exciting. So I actually have less of a role in the chamber version, but still a very active one. I mean, Paula and I are really close creative collaborators, so everything we do, we really do together. But Paula has taken on all of this new work, which is very exciting to see. So my job is to revision the piece, and it really does take on an entirely new quality. I had a costume designer do a completely new costume design for the piece, and have sort of shifted much of the set design for the piece. And it's now much more what I would say is highly theatrical. It is less based in realism and more based in sort of the theatricality of shifting from one character to another, from one place to another. So it has a much more, it feels to me like a much more magical quality. And because of the way the costume design works with the set design, it actually backs that up. So it was a matter of really revisioning the piece and also working swiftly. We're working quite quickly. We took a long time to work together to build the opera into being this shorter and more concise and distilled version. And then when you're working with professional singers and really professional musicians, the whole process moves much more swiftly, which was actually exciting. I really loved it. That's the kind of thing where you can say something once to a group of five people and it happens instantly, as opposed to when you're saying it to 40 or 50 people, there's sort of a long process in getting things to move along. So it's a sleeker, faster, more mobile kind of machine than it was before.
Mm. Yeah. I was wondering if you could talk about, about your lead, who's able to join us.
Do you want to do that, Paula? Do you want to talk about the audition process and that magic of meeting Marianne?
Yes, Marianne is a wonderful soprano. She went to Spelman College. She sings in the American Spiritual Ensemble, which is where she is right now. She's on tour with them in Ecuador. She really impressed us, not only physically, that she's a tall, strong, self-possessed woman like Sojourner Truth, but that she's an activist in her own right. She works for a local senator, and she really resonates with this story in a way that is so special.
Yeah, that was the thing that blew me away in her audition, was just the strength of heart and character that she has that just resonated through this character. I mean, it's just, and it's been such a joy as a director to work with someone who really feels the power and the importance and the need for this woman's story to be told. And so as a conduit for that story, the vibration is so strong and so high of what is brought on the stage when it's brought through this wonderful woman, Marianne Pringle. Very, very, very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Just gorgeous.
Yeah. I think it'd be really great to play maybe one more of the clips, because we are out of time, unfortunately. The one that I have ready is I'm Going Home.
Oh,
that's
wonderful.
Great. That's the last scene of the opera.
Okay.
And it's beautiful. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I want to thank both of you before I play it so much for joining us to talk about Truth, the opera, and certainly looking forward to perhaps another conversation at a future date to talk more about Truth on the Road as in its chamber version.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Wanda.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye, Wanda. Thank you.
Bye.
That was great.
Bye. Bye. Thanks.
Director of the National Park Service. Good morning. How are you? Uh-oh. Don't hear anything. Let's see. Try this one. Ah, there you are. Mr. Stanton, how are you? Oh, don't hear anything there either. Well, darn. Well, we'll have to see what's going on.
No. Can you hear me okay?
Oh, now I hear you.
Okay, good. Thank you.
For a second. Oh, it's great to have you on to talk about, my goodness, the establishment of a national monument honoring Harriet Tubman. So let me finish giving your title, and then I'll read your bio after we talk a little bit about this great news.
Yes.
Yeah, so you are the former director of the National Park Service. And I believe as an African-American man that you are the first director of the National Park Service, are you?
That is correct. I was honored and privileged to serve as the 15th director of the National Park Service in the Clinton administration.
Ah.
And I was invited back to be a part of the Obama administration as a senior advisor to Secretary Ken Salazar, the Department of Interior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm definitely interested in finding out sort of how you came, you know, into the National Park Service, because we are represented, but we're not overrepresented there.
Well, you're very kind. I'm going to date myself. I'm a product, if you will, of the Kennedy-Johnson-Udall administration. President Kennedy and President Johnson appointed a young congressman from the state of Arizona as their Secretary of the Interior, and his name was Stuart Lee Udall, and he was very disturbed about the lack of absence of diversity within the workforce of Interior. And, of course, that was during the height of the modern civil rights movement back in the early 60s. So he directed a cadre of recruiters to go into historically black college and universities for the very first time for any significant recruiting in those places by Interior, and I was selected as a seasonal ranger in Grand Teton National Park in 1962, and then eventually became a career employee with the National Park Service in 1966, and worked my way up and stepped down as a director in January 2001. It was a great privilege and a great honor to have served the American people in that capacity.
Right. Wow. And it was a huge job, you know, running the National Park Service, because, you know, people who are familiar with our national parks knows that that's something really unique.
An awesome responsibility. That is
yeah,
true.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, wow, just reading how that you let's see, you were the first director to undergo confirmation hearings before the U.S. Senate. You managed a workforce of 20,000 employees and an annual budget of $2.3 billion. You had policy planning and management responsibility for the National Park System, 384 natural, cultural, and recreational areas, and you were responsible for the National Park Service areas, programs, and offices located in 49 states, Washington, D.C., Puerto Rico, American, Samoa, Guam, and the U.S. Virgin Islands.
That is correct. An awesome responsibility and a great opportunity, that is for sure.
Tell us about this latest addition to our national monuments.
Yes, we are so proud of the action taken by President Obama on March the 26th, Monday of this week, using the authorities vested in the President of the United States through the Antiquities Act, legislation acted by Congress, signed into law in 1906. And President Obama used that authority with respect to the African-American heritage to designate two national monuments, one honoring Harriet Tubman at her birthplace on the eastern shore of Maryland, and the other is to honor Colonel Charles Young. And at the time that he was in the U.S. Army, or if you will, in the U.S. Cavalry, he was the highest-ranking African-American to attain the rank of colonel, and he was the third African-American to graduate from West Point. And I could just go on and on and on about the two of those giants, but we're very humbled and very honored to have that perpetual responsibility to preserve and to promote the legacies of Miss Harriet Tubman, known as the most prominent conductor of the Underground Railroad, if you will, that she risked her own life to return on numerous occasions to those areas which still held my ancestors, if you will, in slavery, to move them to a new breath of freedom on the Underground Railroad, going from the South to the North, then eventually into Canada. Because of the Fugitive Slave Act, one would not be free from capture if they stayed in Philadelphia or Boston. They had to go all the way to Canada because of the Fugitive Slave Act. So we'll tell that full story about her courageous efforts, and her legacy will be a source of inspiration not only for this, but indeed future generations.
Mm-hmm. So on the day that this the building of this monument was announced, tell us about, you know, sort of who was there and what was the feel of the, those in attendance. I believe General Tubman's ancestors were present.
They were there, and you could see the joy and the pride in their faces. Yes, Secretary Salazar was there himself. And Director of the National Park Service, the 18th Director of the Park Service, John Jarvis, and members of the community, representative of the county of Dorchester, and it was just an outpouring of inspiration. I would might add that also the state of Maryland, under the leadership of Governor O'Malley and the state legislature, the leadership of Cambridge, Dorchester County, they have also established a state park honoring a native daughter, if you will, of Maryland. And it's just a great coming together you know, as a people and as a nation to recognize her legacy.
Mm-hmm. So this new park, I believe it's, let's see, what number is it? The 399th unit
of the
National Park System. What's going to be the look of it? Because I read that it seems to be unique, but it's also in keeping with Harriet Tubman's legacy.
Yes, it. One of the great beauties of many for this park is that it really creates a tremendous partnership between the federal government, the state government, and local communities, in that the boundary of the monument encompasses the state park, although the state will continue to administer their park, and then you have the U.S. Fish and Wildlife that preserve the natural beauty of that area as if it were in the same condition during Miss Tubman's childhood and the time that she would return to direct and to lead those enslaved persons up north, if you will. Mm-hmm. So really the monument speaks to preserving the landscape as if it that kind of a pastoral scene, that kind of agricultural scenes, that wooded scene existed as if she was still living. And that will give particularly the young people the kind of environment that she was confronted with growing up and the kind of environment that she would have to confront as she came into the plantations to lead others on waterways or hidden trails or whatever the case may have been. And it's just a very moving experience. And the Dorchester County leadership, the Fish and Wildlife leadership, the Park Service leadership, and with the private sector have contributed to a drive-in tour that you can really sort of experience what it would have been during her childhood there in Eastern Shore, Maryland. And one of the things, too, that there obviously are many benefits to having a state park and fish and wildlife a refuge, and now with the monument, it will not only attract many visitors from the state of Maryland and from across the country, and indeed internationally, it would help with you know, employment by state and federal agencies, and obviously it contributes to the economy through tourism. So we are very excited that as the planning and as the development and as more information is available to the visiting and the traveling public, it's just going to be a destination, if you will, for so many people to just experience the legacy of Mrs. Tubman. I might also mention that another giant was born into that institution of slavery in an adjoining county, in Talbot County, one of our great heroes who also is memorialized in the national parks is Frederick Douglass. He was born in Talbot County, in adjoining county.
Oh.
So it's just a rich area.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. Yes, I know there's a Frederick Douglass Museum. Is he also commemorated in a national monument?
Yes. Well, in fact, his home, his last place of residence, is a National Historic Site. My first superintendency had responsibility for the Douglass home. Legislation authorizing the Douglass home was signed on September 5, 1962 by President Kennedy. And if any time you're in Washington, D.C., you want to visit the Frederick Douglass National Historic Site. And as you know, Mr. Douglass and Ms. Harriet Tubman were great, great friends, and they were leading abolitionists. They were great friends.
Tell me some details about that story.
Well, you know, Mr. Douglass again was born into slavery there in Eastern Shore in Maryland, and he eventually gained his freedom with the help of a lot of friends, and certainly with his first wife, and moved into Massachusetts, and then he became an outspoken lecturer. He was a gifted orator and writer, and one of the strong advocates for President Lincoln authorizing African-Americans to be recruited and placed in active duty in the Union forces. He was a very strong colleague with Mrs. Tubman in helping those to come into freedom via the Underground Railroad. And they were just great, great friends. But both of them very, very unwavering in their commitment to help those who were still enslaved, and they both personally obviously experienced the brutality of slavery. So they just felt that they were willing to give all of their own to help others.
Right.
And it was just a magnificent story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've been talking a lot about Sojourner Truth this morning, and I was wondering, she and Mrs. Tubman and Frederick Douglass,
It is absolutely fantastic. Sojourner Truth and her noted speech, "Ain't I a Woman Too?" That is very moving. Sojourner Truth is also memorialized as a part of a recognition of the women's suffrage movement, in that the Park Service administers the Women's Right National Historical Park in Seneca Falls, New York. And Sojourner Truth is memorialized there as a part of a statue that includes Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Chrisha Mott, and interestingly enough, the only male that is commemorated there in terms of the women's suffrage is none other than Frederick Douglass. He was
one of
the most outstanding spokespersons ever for women's suffrage. Yeah, he was not only concerned about African Americans having the right to vote, but he gave his all for the right of women to vote too, which came about, as you well know, in the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution.
Wow.
I might mention that if you were to take a look at the breadth of the areas in the national park system, now 401, I believe, is that there are two other African American women that are memorialized. One is Dr. Mary McLeod Bethune, whose parents were emancipated from the cotton fields in South Carolina, and the other is Maggie Lena Walker, National Historic Site in Richmond, Virginia, an outstanding businesswoman, civic leader, philanthropist. She was the first woman ever in the United States to find a to establish and to operate or to administer a savings bank, starting in 1903. So there's a memorial, there's a historic site honoring Magdalena Walker in Richmond, and in Washington, D.C., you not only have Dr. Bethune recognized once, but she's recognized twice, both by specific acts of Congress. The first one is a memorial authorized by Congress in 1960, and the legislation authorized the National Council of Negro Women, an organization that Dr. Bethune founded in 1935. Congress authorized that council to construct a memorial on parkland to honor Dr. Bethune, and that memorial was dedicated in 1974. And then subsequently, Congress authorized what they call the Bethune Council House National Historic Site, which is located on Vermont Avenue in Washington, which was the first headquarters of the National Council of Negro Women, and the only archives for African American women, and it includes some of the original writings of Dr. Mary McLeod Bethune. She was just a phenomenal leader. She was an advisor, I believe, to four or five presidents. She founded the Bethune-Cookman College in Daytona Beach, which is one of our thriving historical black colleges today. And she's a personal inspiration to me, along with Mr. Douglas and Sojourner Truth and certainly Ms. Harriet Tubman.
And Dr. Height.
Well, if you want me to stay on this phone about a week, I can talk about Dr. Dorothy Irene Height. She was my mentor. She was my advisor. And when I was being considered by President Clinton as the director of the National Park Service, she sent a beautiful letter, and it's one of those frameable type letters. But she and I worked closely together for almost 40 years. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That is really...
Yeah, Dr. Dorothy Irene Height. Yeah.
That is such a gift.
Oh, no question about that.
Wow.
Yeah, she would have been
100. 40 years, oh my goodness.
Yeah. Well, I'm dating myself. Oh, yes. Oh, that's true. Yeah, she would have been 101 this month. Yeah.
Isn't that amazing? Wow, 101 and on the 100th anniversary of
Harriet Tubman,
Harriet Tubman's transition, which was March 10th, this national monument happens.
You're right. But I would tell you this, as we spoke about Dr. Bethune, Mary McLeod Bethune, if you knew Dr. Height, you knew Dr. Bethune. If you knew Dr. Bethune, you do Dr. Height. I mean, she carried out her legacy to the tilt, and it's unbelievable. She was a remarkable lady.
Yeah, really selfless, though. You think about, Dr. Height. You think about Dr. Mary McLeod Bethune.
And Harriet Tubman.
And you think about Harriet Tubman.
Giving them themselves,
like,
right.
Yeah.
Unbelievable, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, real selfless. And
that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was looking at the location of the new national monument, Maryland's eastern shore. And you already mentioned that it includes large sections of landscapes that are significant to Tubman's early life in Georgia County. And evocative of her life as an enslaved person and conductor of the Underground Railroad. And these include Stewart's Canal, dug by hand, free and enslaved people, including Tubman, between 1810 and the 1830s. And Stewart's Canal is a part of the Blackwater National Wildlife Refuge.
Right, which is also an interior unit of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, right, yeah. Mm-hmm. So they'll be telling the story as well.
Okay, cool,
yeah.
Super.
Yeah.
And then there's another, this new monument also includes the home site of Jacob Jackson. Why don't you tell
that
us
is
about
correct.
Jacob Jackson home site?
Yeah, he was a free African-American, and even though he was free, and Ms. Tubman, when she would come back, she was free too, but he recognized that he had a sense of responsibility to help people to move into freedom, either to have someone to buy them and give them a freedom and stay in the area, or to move as an enslaved person on the Underground Railroad. And he risked his all to do that. And he provided certain messages and certain symbols to Ms. Tubman as they moved along. And I think in terms of Colonel Charles Young, who also received an honor by President Obama in terms of the designation, and he was one of great humility and a sense of humanity, always wanting to help others. So we're very proud of that as well. And I'll be joining Secretary Salazar and Director Jarvis and others in Wilberforce, Ohio, on Monday to publicly announce the Charles Young Buffalo Soldiers National Monument, similar to what Secretary Salazar did this past Monday at the Harriet Tubman.
Mm-hmm.
So this is just a very, very rich and very uplifting time for us here in the interior, that's for sure.
Yeah, so is it something about the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation or all these movies? What is it?
Well, I don't know. I suppose that that could be sort of a motivation as well. I was sharing with one of my colleagues, again, dated myself, when I came into the park system, there were only two areas that were in existence. It was monument honoring Booker T. Washington in his home state, and of course he was born into slavery as well in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and the other was George Washington Carver, which was the first one to be established, commemorating his childhood in slavery in Missouri. But now with Harriet Tubman and Colonel Young, there are 26 areas plus the Underground Railroad Network to Freedom. So I have been very much inspired personally and professionally, that as a people in the nation, we are beginning to more fully recognize the contribution and the sacrifices of African American in the development of this country. And similarly, efforts are taken under the leadership of Secretary Salazar in recognizing more women and Latinos. And President Obama used his same authority to designate a monument honoring Cesar Chavez and his leadership role relative to farm workers. So this is just a great outpouring of that kind of leadership.
Mm-hmm. Wow, yeah. So you mentioned 26 areas and the Underground Network to Freedom.
Yes.
What is that?
Well, the Underground Railroad Network to Freedom, again, inspired by Mrs. Tubman. She is known as sort of the principal conductor, but there were a series of conductors because the Underground Railroad was not only nationally, it was internationally. As I mentioned earlier, with the Fugitive Slave Act, even under the leadership of Ms. Tubman, if you will, coming to Eastern Shore, Maryland, and having some of the enslaved person move northward into New York or whatever you, what this Fugitive Slave Act would allow, that if a slave owner said that he knows where his property is, he could go to New York or he could go and take his slave back. And that was just a sad, sad chapter. So folks had to go into Canada, go into Mexico, go into the Caribbean to really be free, if you will. So the Underground Railroad Network to Freedom was a piece of comprehensive legislation signed into law in 1998 by President Clinton. I had the opportunity to personally witness the signing of the legislation in the Oval Office, and what it encourages the Park Service to work with other federal agencies, state agencies, nonprofit organization and particularly educational youth serving organization to do some original research to try to determine what routes were really taken, what houses and what riverways and what valleys were a part of the escape route, if you will, because it was a secret network. Nobody kept maps. I mean, that was the whole thing. You don't want no people to know how you were traveling from a plantation in Virginia to Canada, whatever the case may be. And it's just a very exciting effort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just reading some more of your bio.
Yes.
That prior to returning to federal service in 2009, you served as an executive professor at Texas A&M University, a visiting professor at both Howard and Yale universities, and board member and consultant to a number of national conservation organizations. But the part that I zeroed in on it because I know what your the university is that you got your undergraduate degree and a bachelor's of science in
Houston Tillerson
University in Austin, Texas. I walked by there quite a few times and went in and
around.
Yeah.
There were two schools founded right after the Civil War, and they merged in 1954. And I'm going back in May. For my 50th class reunion.
Wow, that is so awesome.
Yeah.
It's just it's just wonderful because I've been there, been in Houston, Austin, around the time of the Juneteenth, and they do a big there.
Oh, you mentioned Juneteenth. When I was growing up, of course, all of my childhood and young adulthood was segregated Texas. And Juneteenth was our holiday. We didn't do anything for anybody other than barbecue and what have you. Juneteenth. And the state has officially recognized Juneteenth now.
Right, yeah.
Our day.
And then the wonderful library you have that just has many great programs and so much history.
That is correct, a lot of history.
And now there are a lot of Katrina survivors that live in Austin.
Yes, and it's my understanding that many of them have opted not to return to Louisiana.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's true in Houston as well, in some of the other areas.
A friend of mine, Robert King, is a Katrina survivor that relocated to Austin.
Oh, is that right? Uh huh.
Yeah, he's former. He's one of the only free members of the Angola 3.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So he's on New York Avenue.
Yes. Oh, gosh, something.
Yeah.
Now, where are you located physically now?
I'm in California, Northern California, Oakland.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
And you did your graduate work at Boston University.
That is correct. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I received a grant in aid from Houston Tillerson, approved by then President Dr. J.J. Seabrook, with the understanding that I'll return to my alma mater, and so I did serve on in the administration there 2 years, and then Congress, passed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and then things began really to open up in the government. So I came permanently with the Park Service in '66.
Yeah. You have 5 honorary doctorate degrees.
Yes, fooling somebody.
I should have called you Doctor Stan.
Yeah.
Like, oh my goodness.
Yes, I've had a lot of help along the way, so I'm indebted to so many people for giving a helping hand, and I have a sense of responsibility to try to give of myself if I could.
So do you have a couple of more minutes?
Yes, please do.
I was wondering, in your service, since it's, so much happened, while you were in charge, so to speak, what are you most proud of?
Oh, that's a good one. To have had the opportunity to work with some of the finest men and women in the federal government were the men and women of the National Park Service, and that's inclusive of the over 100,000 volunteers and many partners. But I was very pleased to see new areas come into the National Park System over the course of my career that represents the real diversity of this country. Then on the natural resource side, I am very pleased that under my directorship, we inaugurated what we call the Natural Resource Challenge, which really calls for the Park Service to recommit itself to being the best stewards of our natural resources to the extent possible. I'm speaking of from the grizzly bears to the sequoia trees to the smallest of the mammals and the most beautiful of the small flowers in the parks. All of the natural resources require that we be the best stewards that we can. And we were able to get full support from then Secretary Bruce Babbitt, from President Clinton, Vice President Gore, and a bipartisan support from the U.S. Congress that gave us new funding to, again, to become the best stewards that we could. And that was just a couple other things. The program that we launched was Save America's Treasures, and I worked very closely then with our First Lady, Mrs. Clinton, to not only look at areas within the park system, but other areas within the federal government, state government, and private ownership that required some attention to the preservation of our collective treasures, even including the flag that was flown at Fort McHenry during the War of 1812 that provoked Francis Scott Key to write what we call our national anthem. That flag is fully restored now. So it's just been it was just a great opportunity for some 35 years with the National Park Service.
Yeah.
And we inaugurated some youth programs. The first was the Youth Conservation Corps in 1970. Then when I was a director, we launched the Public Lands Corps. So the involvement of youth is a major goal of Secretary Salazar, and it reflects the commitment of Harriet Tubman and Charles Young and others, is that we have to be responsible to our young people.
That's excellent. Yeah, when I visit Austin, one of the exhibits that I was there. No, actually, I think it's a permanent exhibit in the museum library, and it's around sort of early Austin. You know, looking at Texas and the history there, and their interviews with elders, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, young people might have been participated in that whole project, and. And I think about, you know, black towns and the preservation of them and how a lot of those towns are gone now.
That is correct, yeah.
Yeah, and here in California we have quite a few, but Allensworth is one of the more well-known of those towns.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I was wondering if you could talk about sort of the connection between the National Park Service and the local, regional parks and how they feed into one another.
Yes. There is a seamless mosaic of parks. You have the municipal parks, you have regional parks, state parks, and certainly the national park. Mm-hmm. And there is a lot of exchange in terms of professional development. There's exchange of expertise, information across the line. You'll find that some employees may work for a while with the federal government, then go to a state government, and then come back. But in a real sense, they're all in the same business of preserving the resources and making them available to the public. Some may be more in the preservation mode, vis-a-vis that of recreation, so there's just a good balance here. The other thing, the other activity I may mention in terms of the Park Service is that it has a fairly expansive technical assistant capacity. That is, with landscape architects, with recreation specialists, ecologists, engineers from all disciplines that can work cooperatively with private organization, with other public organizations, in terms of assisting them in upgrading their programs. Also, the Park Service administers the various provisions set forth in the Historic Preservation Act to work with local communities and others in preserving their historical resources. And some of those resources can be developed and become income-producing facilities. And under the law, the person who invests in preserving a historically significant resources can also get some tax benefits from preserving a historic structure. So the Park Service does a lot of work with the communities outside of the national park system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So back to you know, some of these black towns, you know, ones
yes.
that are still around. And I was thinking about Dr. John Hendrick Clark and how he talked about how we need to build our institutions. And then looking at, you know, sort of the trajectory of your career and how
yes.
you were really like instrumental in quite a bit, you know, during your tenure, and a whole lot of wonderful things happened, you know, besides expanding the budget.
Yes, right.
And you know, your authorization of 11 new park areas and
yes.
and 6 national heritage areas and the study of 22 possible new areas and you know, not to mention the wonderful Underground Railroad network to freedom.
Yes.
I was wondering, what's going on? Is anything happening around that, you know, as, you know, sort of farmland is turning into housing developments and, you know, sort of really important areas of our landscape as, you know, Americans is disappearing.
Yes. Secretary Salazar, with the full support of the president, in fact, the president, I think, somewhat engineered this as well, launched to what is called America's Great Outdoors. And obviously it is a partnership effort with other federal jurisdiction, particularly the Department of Agriculture, the Environmental Protection Agency, and others, is to work not only within the federal community, but work with private landowners, the ranchers, the farmers, the mayors, to preserve our natural and cultural landscape throughout the country. We recognize that many of our lands will continue to be developed for housing, commercial purposes, for farming and ranching and what have you. But the question is, can we do it in an ecologically sensible way so that we can preserve some are open spaces, and notwithstanding that they are being used for other purposes. And it is a great, great program and has received tremendous support from private landowners. And obviously this includes working with the many, many tribal governments, the American Indian leadership, who have a lot of magnificent open spaces on their reservations or on trust land, and it's called America's Great Outdoors. And as you mentioned, that we are losing some open spaces. So the question is, how can we continue to utilize our public lands and private lands to meet our societal needs, but do it in a way that future generations can enjoy the openness that we enjoy today?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So when on Monday when President Obama established the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad National Monument, he also established 4 others, and you mentioned the one designated to Charles Young Buffalo
yes,
Soldiers
right.
National Monument in Ohio, home of a distinguished officer in the United States Army who was the 3rd African-American to graduate from West Point.
That is correct.
And the 1st to achieve the rank of colonel.
That is correct.
Yeah. But there were three others.
Yeah, if I may, just briefly on Colonel Charles Young.
Yeah,
and I have a... Well, I have an affinity for him and understand and appreciate his legacy from a number of perspectives, but I'll be fairly brief on this, is that when he was in a leadership role with the U.S. Cavalry, the Secretary of the Interior at that time had responsibility for a number of parks, And of course, this was before the National Park Service was established in 1916. So the Secretary of the Interior called upon the Secretary, called then Secretary of War, that we call Department of Defense today, said that, you know, I need some assistance in protecting some of these areas. Mm-hmm. And Secretary of War said, I'll do this if Congress will agree to it. And Congress did. So Secretary of the Interior needs some assistance in protecting the values and the resources of Yosemite and Sequoia National Parks in California as an example. And Captain Charles Young at that time led a contingent of Buffalo soldiers from Presidio into Sequoia and Yosemite. And at Sequoia, he served as the acting superintendent there during the summers of 1903. So he had not only in terms of strict military accomplishment, but he was a conservation leader, if you will. Mm-hmm. And that is great. And just a personal twist, he served as the acting superintendent there in 1903, and then the Park Service was established later on in 1916, and I had the honor and privilege in 1970 being the first African American appointed as a superintendent in the National Park Service. And plus, he's a fraternity brother of mine of the Omega Psi Phi fraternity.
Oh. Wow, there are a lot of connections there.
Yeah, right. Yeah, he became a member in 1919.
Wow, yeah. That is awesome. So when you did your graduate work, what was it in specifically? Because I noticed
it was
you had
in
a bachelor's.
Yeah, administrative management and public relations. And that was the basis of the grant from Houston Tillerson to return there to serve as the Director of Public Relations and Alumni Affairs, which I did for 2 years. And then I began to take a look at my experiences of having worked there in Grand Teton, and again recognizing that with the 1964 Civil Rights Act that things were beginning to open up in the federal government. And I came on board as a permanent employee in 1966.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I bet, you know, it sounds like, you know, I mean, you know, one thinks about, you know, working in nature, and you think about, you know, the beautiful national parks. It's just so beautiful, and I don't know, it seems like you should always be in a state of relaxation, and just, I mean, things could be busy and things could be stressful, but, you know, because you're, if you're in the great outdoors and not sitting in an office, you know, it just, you know, you just breathe in that clean air and just look at the majesty of the terrain, you know, whether that's the mountains or the, you know, the seacoast, and just feel so inspired.
Oh yeah, and that what does, you know, the natural wonder obviously, and then the our history.
Mm-hmm.
It keeps you motivated. And as I said before, that, you know, just the dedication of the men and women and the volunteers, and certainly with the visitors, I think they all enjoyed. I just think I was a regional director here for the National Capital Region that includes the monuments, memorials in Washington, D.C., and then you just go out and just watch the visitors standing in awe as they walk up the steps at the Lincoln Memorial, see the grandeur of the Washington Monument, and it gives you great joy, and you say, hey, I'm a part of the organization that has this responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Could you hold on just 1 minute, please? Just
yeah,
one
sure.
I'm sorry. Thank you very much.
Oh
yeah, good, yeah, no, good, good.
Well, I
no, but it is just keep you inspired, and I'm beginning to sort of detect that I think you might be ready to come to the National Park Service yourself. I can sense that kind of embracement of the magnificent bounty of this country in terms of the natural beauty and and our rich history.
Yeah, I just thought, you know, like when I retire, I'd like to retire as a park ranger or an interpreter.
That might not work. Now, rangers work. We don't want any retired rangers now.
No, I don't have to lie. I mean, changing, you know.
Changing jobs, huh?
Yeah, changing my career.
Oh,
I'm,
yeah.
I'm a college professor.
Yeah.
But I was thinking it would be really great.
Oh, that would be fantastic.
Yeah.
And we're very proud of the over, I think it's about 160,000 volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
These are individuals of all ages who give themselves. And obviously within that group are a large number of retirees. If, for instance, you come to Washington, D.C., and you go to the Vietnam Veteran Memorial,
yeah.
Many of those assist in one in touring the Vietnam Memorial and try to understand a little bit about the war and what have you. Many of our Vietnam veterans themselves who are volunteers. It is just absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah.
The American
yeah.
people love their national parks, that's for sure.
Right, yeah, I was there in Washington recently at the inauguration. I brought my granddaughter. And
oh,
my
you
niece.
Did? Okay.
Yeah, and so we were able to see the new monument of Dr. Martin Luther King.
Oh, yes,
at
yes.
At nighttime, and that was
oh,
so beautiful.
Oh, at night, yeah. All right.
Yeah, first we went to
yeah.
Lincoln, and then we got over to the King Memorial and looked across the water. I'm like, oh, there's Lincoln.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
so cool.
That's right. Well, you can imagine just, again, how I've observed change. When I came to Washington in 66, we had the Lincoln, we had the Jefferson, and had the Washington Monument, and that was it. So now we got the Vietnam Veteran Memorial, we got the Korean War Memorial, we got the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Memorial, we got the World War II Memorial, we got the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial, and Congress and the administration and a host of others are looking at a memorial that has been authorized. There's some controversy about the planning or the design for the memorial honoring President Eisenhower. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Roosevelt one was. Wow, you know, the different, like, walking through his the different years of
his presidency.
Oh,
it's unbelievable, isn't it? It's a,
that is awesome. So you
it
leave
is.
Martin King, and then you walk that way, and you see how Dr. King was such a student of history.
Oh, no question about that, yeah.
Yeah,
because
when you're reading, it's like, oh, that was in King. That was a part of the,
that's right.
Yeah,
that's
one
right.
of the quotes that he used in one of his speeches. Like,
that's
oh,
true.
My God.
And he recognized the contribution that those who have gone before, such as the Harriet Tubman or Bethune or Colonel Young, and a sense of obligation to build upon that which has been given to us, and we need to make our own contributions in our lifetimes as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Well, it's been so wonderful speaking to you. And
well,
I know you're
let's
have
not
a
be
great
strangers,
time.
And anytime you've got other questions, you need additional information on Harriet Tubman, the Underground Railroad, and certainly Colonel Charles Young. Don't hesitate. Give us a jingle.
Oh, I certainly will. Yeah, and have a wonderful time. You know, at the is it unveiling?
Well, no, it's sort of a public announcement. They know that the president signed the proclamation on Monday, but the secretary himself want to personally convey the message on site to the American people, and that's going to be on Tuesday.
Right.
Yeah.
That's going to be awesome. So I'll look at pictures of that.
Okay. Very well.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, and I want to let people know that for the Harriet Tubman monument, people can visit the park's website at www.nps for National Park Service .gov/HATU.
That's correct.
And then for the Charles Young Buffalo Soldiers National Monument in Ohio, will they do the same first part of /?
They could just do nps.gov, and there will be a link to the new park, and there's probably some more coverage that the Park Service is posting with respect to the two new monuments. In other words, the Park Service, under the leadership of Secretary Salazar, is trying to get the word out to as many people that these are two new units now that belongs to the American people.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And is that one going to be ready in 2015 as well?
Yes. Well, the land, and there's a home there, and there's going to be some upgrading of the home to accommodate visitors to the home, and there'll be developing interpretive and educational material about Colonel Charles Young, but also about the breadth of the accomplishments of the Buffalo Soldiers throughout the country.
Nice, nice. Yeah, and you know, thank you so much for the link to the San Francisco Bay Area. You know?
Oh, yes, yes, right. Well, you know, we like to think of you folks on the West Coast. one of the areas, just in terms of Colonel Charles Young and his leadership in the military, you may want to take a look at Port Chicago, a naval magazine memorial that also came into Park Service Administration during the President Obama's administration, and it speaks about a major event that occurred there, 1944, that in a real sense it propelled President Truman to issue his presidential order in 1948, integrating the armed forces of the United States. So when Colonel Charles Young was there, he was still a segregated military. So just a very, very interesting of the unveiling, if you will, of the all things that have contributed to development of this nation.
Wow, yeah. Yeah, Charles Young was connected to a whole lot.
Yeah,
we know really well, you know, the Port Chicago Mutiny.
Yes.
It was a book by Robert Allen.
That is correct.
Here,
yeah, I've met him, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
professor at UC Berkeley and one of the editors at the Black Scholar. And yeah, and then one of our wonderful composers here actually did an opera on the Port Chicago, Marcus Shelby.
An opera, is that right?
Yeah, it's really, really beautiful. Either it's an opera or it's a symphony. But you don't know it?
No.
Okay, yeah, because I think it debuted. I'm not sure if it's a story that his father told him, but it's been a minute since it came out. I'll send a link to you so you can look it up.
Oh, that'd be perfect.
But there's actually there's a film, a short film that's a part of the regional parks in Richmond about Port Chicago Mutiny.
Uh-huh.
And I saw the film recently, and it was just really terrible the way these men were court-martialed.
No question about that.
And then I think President Clinton. I'm trying to think. What did he do?
Now, he granted clemency. Posthumously to one of them. That was,
full
pardon, if you will,
the
court martial. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, because you know they had them handling live munitions,
another
explosion to happen.
That's right. Mm-hmm. You know, Thurgood Marshall was involved in trying to resolve the court-martial issue. Yeah, it was unbelievable.
Yeah,
unbelievable.
Yeah. And they, you know, went to prison. And
And
when Robert Allen's book came out, some of the few men that were still alive came to the Oakley Museum. And it was like, oh, my
God. Is that
God.
Right? Oh, my.
Yes, yes. And like, oh, my goodness. It was so, like, exciting.
Yeah,
because I don't know if anyone's alive anymore.
I don't know. That was 1944. That's been a while.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a while. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but some of them, the ones that weren't alive, their descendants came and they spoke.
Yeah, sure.
And because people don't realize that when you're court-martialed, your family doesn't get any of the veterans' benefits.
That's true. Yeah. No.
Basically don't have any money on after
that's
that.
That's right. That's right.
So they really suffered.
Yeah.
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 So, yeah, we can go on and on.
Yes.
So
okay.
Speaking to you, Mr. Stanton.
Well, thank you for
Dr.
this opportunity. thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah, and look forward to talking to you again about this monument and your frat brother.
Okay, right. You would like to do that.
Yeah, certainly.
There's the first African-American graduate of West Point is also memorialized in a national park. The park is not named for him, but it's Fort Davis National Historical Site in my home state of Texas. Was Lieutenant Flipper, who was head of the contingent there at Fort Davis in Texas. And there's a bronze bust of Lieutenant Flipper there at the Fort Davis Historic Site.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. That's awesome. Well, I'm really interested. We could talk about this some other time. How would we memorialize our ancestors that came in through these various ports, and during the slavery period? I'm interested in finding out how one would do that, like all the different ports.
Yes. Do you know Mayor Riley of Charleston, South Carolina? I think the historians and others would tell you that probably 60, maybe 70% of all African Americans brought to these shores, particularly during the height of the slavery trade, entered these lands from at Charleston, South Carolina. And Mayor Riley, just one of my heroes, he is developing a museum that would commemorate that chapter in our history. And the Park Service tells some of that at a visitor center there at in Charleston as well. The Park Service has two sites there in Charleston. It's Fort Moultrie that goes back to the Revolutionary War, and also Fort Sumter. And I went down representing the secretary, 2 years ago, Park Service, observing the firing on Fort Sumter by the Confederacy from the shores of Charleston that ignited, if you will, the Civil War, although Mr. Douglas said it was John Brown Raid that where the Civil War actually started, and I think he's right. But that's just a lot of history. But Mayor Riley is really looking at that whole port of entry circumstance and want to do something to memorialize that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, definitely check him out. And for Moultrie, the second Saturday in June for the past, over maybe 15 years or so, they've had a libations for the ancestors.
Yeah,
right,
okay,
there.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you know about that?
Yeah, I knew about it, but I have not personally participated or observed that, but I knew about it. Just further to the whole slavery is that one other program that Park Service administers is called the Gullah Geechee National Heritage Quarter. That speaks to my ancestors, if you will, that were brought from Western Africa, West Africa, and many settled, worked on plantations on the coastal line, and they had a special capability of growing rice.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the culture is still intact on some of the islands off the shore of North Carolina, Georgia, Florida, and South Carolina. So the Heritage Quarter includes those states, Georgia, Florida, North Carolina, and South Carolina. And yeah, the Gullah Geechee Cultural Heritage Quarter.
Are you rich. Are your people Gullah Geechee?
No. Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. Wow.
Not that I know. I'm sure you can trace some roots. On my mother's side, we were moved from by the owner, quote unquote, from Tennessee into Texas. I don't know where they were before they got to Tennessee. Yeah. On my father's side, I don't know. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, because here in the San Francisco Bay Area, we have a Ma'afa commemoration every October.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, and this year makes our 18th annual.
Oh, okay. Great.
Yeah. So I'll certainly send you some information about what we've been doing. And then also recently there's a woman in Baltimore who has been doing marking the ports. All
is that right?
Ports.
That's fantastic. That's exciting.
And so it started last year in August, and she's been to quite a few since then. And the goal is to commemorate the Middle Passage at all the different ports.
Yeah. Well, there's a major effort underway with UNESCO.
Yeah, right.
And talking about the slave routes and what have you. But also there was a port of entry for some of the earlier enslaved persons at Fort Monroe in Virginia. And Fort Monroe now is a national monument established by President Obama. Mm-hmm. So that's very rich. But I know that this lady has that effort on the way.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Yeah, her name is Ann Chin.
Huh. Is she located there in California?
No, she's in Baltimore.
Baltimore.
Yeah, but I can send you I'll send you information about that. Actually we posted this on our website, maafasfsanfranciscobayarea.com. But I'll send you information about all that. Because I was just thinking as you were talking, I was like, man, it'd be great. And I don't know, it might already exist. You could just tell me where it is. For the National Park Service, is there like a place where all of the links that are connected to African American history, like we could like see, okay, this park here and this interpretation there?
Yes.
Is there a way to search it like that?
Yeah, it should be. It should be, yeah. I think the Park Service have area that commemorate a particular racial or ethnic group.
Cool.
And then also sites associated with women and their leadership role.
Nice.
And then shortly after I stepped down as director, co-founded an organization called the African American Experience Fund of the Park Foundation, and it's a partner organization with the Park Service to try to give a little bit more visibility to these areas, such as a Harriet Tubman or Charles Young or Douglas or M.K. site or the Tuskegee Airmen. Because invariably when you're visiting with people who are not into history as such, and you mention the national parks or the park shares, probably in some instances the only thing that conjures up in their mind would be an Everglades or Yellowstone or what have you, and they really don't think about the cultural side and particularly African-American history, and so we're trying to give more visibility. Same thing with the Latino heritage. There's a counterpart organization called the Latino Heritage Fund of the Park Foundation. And certainly now with Cesar Chavez National Monument, we want to sort of bring it into more public awareness or public prominence.
Mm-hmm.
But there are linkage to those sites, right?
Okay, excellent,
yeah.
Okay. Oh, wow, this is just so wonderful.
Well, you've been very kind and very generous with your time. Look forward to it, and we need to stay in touch, that's for sure.
Oh, yes, certainly.
Okay.
Well, you have a good rest of the day, and again, thank you so much.
Now, are you a native of California?
No, actually, my family's from New Orleans.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Yeah.
A neighbor of Texas. I was going to say, if you were a native Californian, we've contributed we, being Texas, have contributed to the leadership there with Willie Brown and former Tom Bradley. They were native Texans.
Yeah.
And Johnny Nash. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Texas. Yeah. we're not selfish in Texas. We like to spread the talent around.
Right. Well, yeah. A lot of great people have come out of Texas with it. We're all the same people.
There you go. Yeah.
All right, you take good care.
Okay, well, thanks again for this opportunity.
Oh, you're welcome.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye, peace and blessings.
Okay, the best.
So now we are going to conclude with some more music from Avery Sharp's Ain't I a Woman. And we're going to hopefully have time for a couple of more pieces, but we're going to play The Way Home.
Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba
that is from Ain't I a Woman, Avery Sharp's Ain't I a Woman, and that was one of the tracks, and you probably see I'm stalling. The Way Home was the name of that particular tune. And I want to have a couple of more announcements, and then I'm going to play another piece, and we'll be out of here. I want to give you a heads up that we have a wonderful interview with the author of the new book about, I guess, the only, one of the only definitive pieces so far on Mrs. Rosa Parks, and this is entitled The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks, hot off the presses, 2013. And this is by Dr. Jean Theo Harris. We had a wonderful conversation yesterday, and was going to play a little bit of it today, but I decided to just hold off, and I'm going to play the entire interview on Wednesday, April 3rd. So tune in, 6 o'clock our regular time for that interview. And hopefully we'll have some folks to talk about the wonderful program and fundraiser for the East Bay Meditation Center on April 4th. And one of the folks at this sort of reflection on the work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the end of what's known as the Season of Peace is Alice Walker. So hopefully we'll have someone on to talk about that benefit and fundraiser. And it's going to be featuring Alice Walker and some other great folks. And that's going to be in Oakland. And the Universe Soul Circus is coming back to Oakland April 4th as well to the 14th. They're going to be at 633 Hagenberger Road near Oakland Coliseum. And for information about group discounts, you can call area code 888-605-9997. And I want to also give people a heads up that if you haven't seen A Shadow in the Clouds, Avitrar, Betsy Coleman's story, Aviator, sorry, Betsy Coleman's story, written and directed by Victor Lawhorn, you have just a few more opportunities tonight and tomorrow at the Black Repertory Group Theater, 3201 Adeline Street in Berkeley, California, 510-652-2120, 652-2120, or blackrepertorygroup.com. And in addition to that, two other plays, which were going to be closing last week, are also going to be having a couple of more performances this weekend as well. And those are the two pieces written by Dr. Clarence Culbertson, Tituba, which looks at the black woman who was accused of witchcraft in Salem, Massachusetts. And it's a really wonderful piece. And the actress who portrays Betsy Coleman is also the actress portraying Tituba, and that's Nathalie. And so it's just really wonderful to see her in these two very different stories do such a great job. And then the other piece by Dr. C is Nat, based on the life of Nat Turner, and that's really well portrayed by an actor. His first name is Clarence, and Clarence is a veteran of the Black Repertory Group Theater, and he is just phenomenal in this particular role as well. So both of these plays are also being performed this weekend, and you have to call 510-652-2120 to find out the scheduling. I know Shadow in the Clouds is tonight at 8 o'clock, but I'm not certain when the other two pieces are being performed. So you need to call and check on that, but you don't want to miss them if you have missed them. And then if you are, have some time on the Resurrection Day, which is Sunday the 31st, at the 57th Street Gallery, The Destiny Muhammad Project is performing. E.W. Wainwright is having his group, and Wukana Mwetu, the anti-apartheid choir, is performing. And so that's from 3 to 6, and there's also going to be dinner. So it's going to be a really wonderful, wonderful afternoon of music. So, so you want to check that out. And if you are in town and not busy, definitely 57th Street Gallery on 57th Street and Telegraph in Oakland is the place. All righty. So looking forward to another edition of Wanda's Picks, and thank you so much for tuning in. And we're going to close out again with another one of Avery Sharp's pieces, and I think we're going to close with Catch the Sunset. I was going to play Bum Free about Sojourner Truth's father, which I promised. I guess I should do what I promised. Okay, we'll do Bum Free, and then we'll do Catch the Sunset. Catch the Sunset. Both are from Ain't I Woman by Avery Sharp. So once again, thank you so much for helping us celebrate the Women's History Month by talking about some really phenomenal African American women, women of African descent, Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman, and other women we call the names of this morning. So thank you so much.